Philip Morgan.
Listen, Witherell.
How are you, man?
I'm pretty good, I think. That's the sigh of a man who's had a long day, but pretty good. How about you, buddy?
Indeed. It was a long day. I gave a webinar for you and some other people, and I find on days like this, my brain is just drained of its ability to cognate.
You did all the work, and I'm still tired.
Well, I'm happy.
That's when you know you're old, when you get tired watching other people work.
Right, I know, and get off my lawn and all that. So, Philip, what do you want to promote today? I think we should get in the habit of promoting things, and it's your turn to do it.
Well, I recently revised my services page on philipmorganconsulting.com/services, 1L and Philip. And I took some advice from Blair Enns and did a little bit of price anchoring. So I have listed my most expensive service first, which, full disclosure, I've never sold. But it's an in-person workshop here in California wine country.
Beautiful California wine country.
$5,000 for one day, $8,000 for 2 days. And then it's the stuff that people actually do buy listed in descending order of price beneath that. But what's interesting to me about the page is I spend about as much time talking about other people's services as I do my own, because I'm just trying to let people know there's this amazing ecosystem of support for their dev shop. If they don't need help with positioning, that's cool. They should follow the numerous links on that page to find out about other people's services. And B, it kind of creates almost a negative space of where my services are unique and nobody else, as far as I know, is really doing exactly what I'm doing. So that's what I want people to check out if they feel like they need some help with positioning or specialization or lead generation. But I'm just going to make you work on positioning and specialization if you need help with that. philipmorganconsulting.com/services. How about you, Liston? You have anything promotion worthy today?
Well, that's debatable. I'll let the listener decide that, but I will nevertheless promote something. And just to piggyback on what you said, Philip, on positioning, with your help, I have positioned myself, at least preliminarily, and I help freelancers and consultants sell with confidence. And I'm really excited to really focus all of my efforts on helping people solve this problem of how do I sell more confidently and without the awkwardness that often comes with these conversations and the difficulty in talking about money and all those kinds of things. So what I would invite you to do is go to my website, liston.io, click on articles, and I have two articles there. One is designed to help you get more freelance projects as quickly as possible. So that's not with marketing, that's not with positioning or the opening act or anything else that I've talked about. It's something else. And there's also an article there to help you have better sales conversations. So if you just go to liston.io/articles, you'll find some valuable, hopefully, help there.
Nice.
Now, Philip, speaking of marketing stuff, I had this question. I forgot exactly how this came up, but someone was asking me, maybe it was Kai Davis, I'm not sure. Uh-huh. One of the questions was, at what point do you recommend that freelancers, consultants, software programmers, whoever, basically independents or really small shops, at what point should they have marketing infrastructure? Which also begs the question, what is marketing infrastructure? And in particular, what is a sufficient amount of it? And I thought it was a really wise question, mm-hmm. because you hear stories of people building these really sophisticated machines that just do all the work for them, and the work is just flowing in, and that's amazing. And of course, who wouldn't want that? And you hear mm-hmm. other stories where people don't build any outward-facing marketing, and they build a whole business without any kind of footprint online or elsewhere. And so I thought it was interesting to kind of wrestle with, how do we think about this problem of marketing infrastructure? When should I have it, and how much is enough?
Yeah, I'll provide an example that's just recently come across my radar to kind of drive home that point. I was sort of eavesdropping, is not the right word, but looking at a Slack conversation that was happening, and this guy who does consulting for this particular specialized high-end content management system that's used in very, very large enterprise businesses was talking about how he now has like doubled his business revenue with retainer contracts, which are advice-only retainers, not prepaid blocks of hour retainers. And, you know, he's like has some retainer clients at like $6,000 to $10,000 a month, which I know for a lot of folks is like they would have died and woke up in heaven if they felt like they could actually achieve that.
Of course.
So I went and looked at his website, and there's like no listing of services there. It was just a blog. And I don't say that in a dismissive way, but I just say that to sort of illustrate that that's a thing that sometimes happens. Sometimes you have essentially no infrastructure whatsoever. And there are plenty of consultants, I think, whose, you know, their marketing infrastructure is basically a brochure website, and they are, you know, making multiple six figures of revenue working with clients based on this, the strength of a couple dozen kind of key relationships. Right. So I guess I just say that to set up what we're about to say. There's exceptions to every rule. You know, lots of things can work depending on the context of the situation. But I think what we're going to probably do is a kind of minimum basic requirement you might look at. And requirement is not the right word, but kind of a minimum threshold of like, what are the pieces you might need to start to get leads online? Maybe that's how we should scope this is, you know, if your business development involves picking up, you know, like a big rotary phone and like dialing it and talking to people, and that's how you get new business, maybe what we were going to say is not really going to apply.
Philip, I believe you're the only person on earth who still owns a rotary phone, so that won't apply to anyone listening to this.
I don't even own a rotary phone. I just was kind of wanted to evoke that image of like somebody with an ashtray on the desk and a big blotter with a calendar, you know, remember those desk blotter calendars?
Oh yeah, of course.
And like that just kind of old school imagery is really what I was trying to evoke.
the rotary phone makes me think of two physical locations. One is the nurse's office of my elementary school. And the second is my grandparents' house, because they had like a wooden cabinet phone with the speaker that extends out. It's kind of like a cartoon. I wish I had that, actually. That would be a cool thing to have still. So I think that this also begs a bigger question, which is, since some people are able to build their business without any online leads whatsoever or without marketing infrastructure, why should I have it in the first place? And to me, you said something really important, which is, you know, I've also met not many, trust me, the numbers are very slim, but a few people who've made multiple six figures early in their freelancing or consulting career. And the reason is always the same. When they started, they had all of the relationships that they needed to ever make the amount of money that they wanted to make, right? They already had those in place. Yeah. And so I think a big thing to think about here is what some of this marketing infrastructure allows you to do is effectively, it's a tool to help you create these relationships that you need in order to grow your business. And so I think that that's the big backdrop for me, at least, is the point of marketing, the point of selling is to advance our business and create new relationships that are meaningful to us and to the person we're talking to. And that's the point of the marketing infrastructure. It's a tool that enables us to do that.
Yeah, we'll see if this sticks for me, but I'm sort of challenging myself to use the word marketing less. And so what I use instead of that is a very short, I mean, not a short enough phrase, but a short phrase, connect and build trust with prospective clients.
Right.
Because to me, that's the essence of marketing. And Seth Godin has this, I know I'm taking us off track here, but Seth Godin has this, it's almost like a business Zen koan where he says, you don't market to people, you market with people. And it kind of flips, you know, it really emphasizes that it's about the relationships and it's about community. It's about connection. It's not about like influence or conversion rate or stuff like that. And I just love how evocative that very short phrase is. I haven't quite gotten there myself with my way of describing it, but I'm just reinforcing what you're saying, that for some people, you know, a freaking rotary telephone is literally the only tool they need.
Yep.
And, but all these are tools. They're not magic. They're not, you know, just add water and this is going to magically transform your business. They are tools that can be used or not used. They can be effective or not effective. They can be the right tools or not the right tools.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do for the purpose of this now, you know, I'm sure people are thinking, okay, well, do I need a website? Do I need marketing automation? Like, how much fancy stuff do I need? Like, how much do I need to learn? And I think what's more important for me, at least, is to focus on the jobs that we want these tools to do. Like, what do we want it to accomplish for us?
Mm-hmm.
And so when, actually, why don't we focus on this first, Philip? So when, how about this? When do I start thinking about putting some sort of infrastructure in place to allow me to market with people or to make mm-hmm. these connections and relationships that I want? When is the right time?
Ooh, that's a good one. I have this theory that I think is a pretty good fit for reality, which is that when a lot of us launch into the world of self-employment, and I guess to be specific, I'm talking about people who maybe had a job or a series of jobs for a while. And so they didn't do this first thing when they started working. You know, it came a little later. For people in that situation, they go independent for whatever reason. And I think their network, both their, you know, their sort of formal business network and their friends and family and, you know, their anybody who knows them really is rooting for them and will try to create opportunities for them to be successful as a newly self-employed person. And that creates this kind of tailwind effect that I think lasts for maybe a year or even as long as 3 years in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of peters out and it creates this oh shit moment when if you don't get ahead of that. And I talk to people sometimes who are at that oh shit moment, and I always wish they'd contacted me about a year earlier. So I'm going to say that maybe your first year as a self-employed, whatever, you maybe don't need to do this, but I think you should be thinking about this in year two. And that's the reason why I'm so specific with that number. Obviously, you know, your mileage may vary. Different people's situation are different, but I would say you could go a year without really thinking about this stuff. But in year two to year three, you really need to, I think, be starting to take this more seriously because the burden of doing business development is going to shift more to you. It was always on your shoulders, but you had help those first couple years for most people's situation. What do you think?
So usually, here's the first thing I'll say. Usually when you have the moment when you say, I should probably be doing something mm-hmm. to support my marketing efforts or my business development, you should have done it yesterday yeah. when you have that first thought, because
yeah.
you're usually thinking it because not that it's too late, but the time that it would have been useful had already passed. And that's what yep. got you to think about it in the first place. So that's yep. the first thing I'd say. So if you're listening to this and you have no infrastructure in place, here's what I would recommend looking back. And part of it depends on who your clients are, obviously, but if I could do it over again, I would have just focused on getting my LinkedIn page really, really right in terms of the headline and what's on there and who I'm servicing and getting that correct. And then also, I believe, some very basic version of a website. You don't even mm-hmm. need to have your services. You need mm-hmm. your face and your name so you can own your name when people Google it if you're on your own. And some statement about what you do to help people.
Yeah.
And I, you know, a single landing page, Squarespace is great for this. They have a whole section of their builder that's yeah. dedicated to this, where you just put up a placeholder with your image, your name, and something about what you do, and a button people can click to contact you. In the beginning, I yeah. think that that's sufficient.
Yeah, there's a service called about.me that can produce something very similar.
They haven't gone out of business yet, Philip?
Gosh, listen, let's see.
I don't know how in the world they could possibly make it. No, they're still there. You're right.
They're still there. And what's nice is you don't get a lot of options with about.me. So you will, those of you, and I'm one of you, by the way, who can get sucked into these rabbit holes of, like, you know, chrome plating or gold plating things excessively. You won't have too much temptation with that. So that's an option. But of course, I can't help but say this. It's in my contract. This happens after you've made some decision about who you're focused on, who you're serving,
yes.
Right? You have to have some level of intentionality about that. Otherwise, I would say you may as well take whatever time you're going to spend doing this and light it on fire and flush it down the toilet, because it's not going to be super effective. The LinkedIn thing's interesting because a lot of us do get this message from various quarters that you're some kind of digital sharecropper if you're building an audience on somebody else's platform. Mm-hmm. And that is true, but you're not building an audience, people. You're just trying to get the basic foundation in place so that you can do some basic business development. So I do agree with you, Liston, that LinkedIn's probably an underutilized asset for a lot of us.
Well, it's free, so that's number one.
Yeah.
You don't have to maintain it. You just have to go fill out your profile. People are actively searching for people like you on LinkedIn. So it's also a search engine of people. Mm-hmm. And you get, you know me, Philip, I'm big on LinkedIn, and like, I can give you all the ins and outs of it, but it is an aid in people's vetting process, right? So it's another credibility point. So the main reason I recommend LinkedIn and a very basic website is anytime you talked about friends and family and kind of your first clients, right? So within that first year, some people will start talking about you and what you do with unbeknownst to you. There needs to be, or at least ideally, some digital footprint, because if someone takes it upon themselves to go look for you and explore a little bit more about, oh, someone mentioned Philip, I want to find out about Philip. It would be great if they found something and you had some control over what they found, right?
Yeah.
So your LinkedIn page is good for that, and the website is good for that. Now, you talked about an audience. So a lot of people tell us, go out and build an email list.
Right.
And it is a very challenging thing to do. It's not easy, and it requires a lot of work. Yeah. So when you're working with your clients, I'm going to put you on the spot here. At what point do you recommend that they think about having an email list, and why?
Yeah, so I'm gonna do two things here. I'm gonna keep riffing on the digital sharecropper thing because I've got some really interesting short stories to tell about that. I'll answer that one first. Building an email list.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Can you just take a second to define what you mean by that? Digital sharecropper.
That's a term from Brian. Who's the? He was briefly on my email list, by the way. Copy blogger, Brian, what's his last name?
Clark,
yeah. He briefly joined my email list. We corresponded a little bit.
What a jerk.
And then he unsubscribed later.
What a jerk.
I don't blame him.
He's dead to me.
Enough email as it is. Anyway, I think he coined that term, or that's where I heard it from. So digital sharecropper is... the idea is that you're building your audience on somebody, on a platform that is owned and controlled by somebody else. So an example would be you somehow kind of strike gold and you build a very rapidly growing Facebook group. And all of a sudden you've got like 10,000 people in this Facebook group. And it's easy to say, holy crap, you know, having an audience, having the trust and attention of that many people, of course, it's not going to be the entire 10,000, but you think in those terms, as the audience owner, you look at your total list size and you think that's how many people care. And it's a subset. It's never the whole list. But that detail aside, you're like, holy crap, what power, what to, you know, make money or excite people or, you know, or, you know, whatever. Like it feels so powerful to have that audience, but Facebook could make a decision that, you know, takes the power of that away from you overnight. It's happened to people. So that's the essence of digital sharecropping, is you don't own the land. You don't own the platform. Whereas if you have an email list, you do own it. You have like complete ability to take it to some other platform if you want. And that's a very old argument about where should you build an audience. That's not really relevant here, but just to define that term for people. So your question was, how quickly should people build an email list? I think of having an email list kind of like owning an exotic sports car, like a Ferrari. Let's say that I got really just in love with some kind of, let's say a vintage Ferrari, right? And I'm just like, oh my God, that car is so sexy. And it just, you know, the way the engine sounds and, you know, the way it looks and drives and all that stuff. And what people who don't do their due diligence find out about buying a vintage Ferrari is that it's going to spend as much time in the shop as it is on the road, maybe more time in the shop. And that's true of a lot of these sort of supercars, is they're very maintenance intensive. The right. same thing is true of an email list.
Right.
If you don't have a plan for how you're going to interact with that mailing list in a way that is, you know, fits your schedule and the time budget that you have. In other words, if you can't invest in it, if you can't afford the maintenance, then don't do it. It's just not worth it, I think, to have a cold email list that you don't engage with. So there's no like, you know, T minus the number of years after you go in business is when you should have an email list. And everybody who has been successful at building an email list that's a real asset for their business will tell you they wish they'd done it sooner. But you got to, you know, be realistic about this stuff and acknowledge that when you start out working for yourself, you know, you're like putting out 1,000 fires all the time. And if you try to grow an email list the right way, it's sort of like adding a problem rather than a benefit to your business. So for a lot, you just have to be ready for it is what I say. It's
all right. I think you went a little bit too aggressive on downplaying the email list. So I don't know that you're adding a problem, but you are adding something else to manage, to your point. So
a responsibility,
right. Your list of things to do just grew by not just one thing, but several things. So you need to maintain the list. You need to email these people. You need to respond to people on a regular basis. I even like to monitor it. I think it depends on how many subscribers you have, but when, for instance, Philip, I'll give you a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Someone who's on your list joined my list. I didn't know that at the time. I looked mm-hmm. him up because I still get pinged when people add. Yeah. And I visited his website and I said, hey, you train consultants. Like, mm-hmm. You and I should talk about working together in some way. And he goes, oh, that's so funny. I found you because of Philip Morgan and I'd love to talk to you. Nice. Right. Which is great because, like, he's a potential referral part. Who knows what'll come of it? But, you know, these are the types of things. But, you know, here I am being bombarded in the middle of my day in my inbox looking at this, right? Or I'm sending a new email and then I'm building. There's a strong temptation to get fancy with mm-hmm. if someone clicks this, tag them that way and then put them into this other campaign. And Philip, you're really good at that. But I think people need to think about, one is there any future use of this? So this would be my criteria.
Yeah.
Is there some foreseeable utility to having this email list? Almost universally, I would say the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. And the second thing is, can you email them at least semi-regularly? Let me scratch that. Consistently. So it could be once a quarter. It could be once a month. Philip, you email every day. That's definitely not my flavor, but sometimes I go every day and sometimes I go a few times a week, but I'm mm-hmm. fairly regularly in touch with people. Mm-hmm. Can you do that? You know, you're going to have to answer that question. It's a commitment you'll have to make, because what you'll see is, I think the average age of any email address, corporate email address, is about 18 months, something like that. And then they go bad. Uh-huh. So you're going to see turnover in your email list also.
Yeah. Half the people who've ever joined my email list ultimately unsubscribe, which is fine. Like, if that's going to hurt your feelings, then, you know, just change your expectations, because, I mean, you might be able to retain more subscribers by emailing less, but I think I don't know what I'm trying to say there. Anyway, it's very common for people to sign up and leave. That's not a big deal.
Well, I think the other thing to think about is how do you want to spend your relationship building time? So if you're really comfortable writing and sending emails on a regular basis, then obviously an email list is something you should consider. If you're really comfortable on the phone reaching out directly to a few people, it's maybe not something you even need. Now, for me personally, I foresee my business long-term having a big volume component. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, I need a volume of people to reach out to. And so I'm combining my efforts in social media and writing and content promotion all to point back to my email list. That'll be the main place that I want to communicate with people and bring them into my orbit. And so that's why the email is so important for me. Now, if you're one of these consultants who has all the right relationships in place and you don't have an aspiration to be an author, speaker, some sort of known personality, I don't really see a strong reason to have an email list at all.
Yeah. I hope what the folks at home take away from this thus far is there really are, I mean, I don't think there's really any recipes. They're frameworks, right. You know, bread generally has flour in it, generally has something that binds the flour together. You know, it has these ingredients and you can find a million recipes for bread, but I feel like focusing on recipes in what we're talking about now is kind of a fool's errand. Like there's frameworks. And I think that's what we're trying to get at here is for thinking about it.
So let's beat your bread metaphor to death or analogy to death. So what I'm saying is think about, do I want, you know, multi-grain bread or do I want sourdough bread? Now, if I wanted sourdough bread, there would be a bunch of different ways I can make it and different ingredients.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm saying is like, spend some time thinking about, well, what am I really trying to build here? And I'm big on the Dilbert guy, Scott Adams, who's gone way off the deep end since Trump ran for president. But
yeah.
We won't talk about that. But he was on Tim Ferriss and he talked about thinking in systems. And I think it's a really wise concept. And basically what he's saying is, you know, what he tried to do throughout his career is figure out what are the big themes or currents that he wanted to focus on. And he knew they would, even if the way he's applying them today doesn't apply in the future, he'd be able to use them in some other way. So in other words, if you say, well, I want to develop an email list because I want to be able to regularly share an update about some cool thing I have in mind, then you should build it. And maybe later you decide, you know, I'm going to totally change directions, but you still have people who are interested in hearing from you, then it's still useful. So I think that's what I'm saying. If that was clear as mud, I'm not sure.
You know, I'm thinking of two people who are clients of mine. One just kind of tangentially worked his way sort of through the back door into having some expertise around blockchain. And, you know,
is that hot right now?
Yeah, seriously. You know, if you're anywhere within, you know, I don't know. Anyway, it's a very hot thing right now. It's very hypey. And so he set up, this is back to the digital sharecropping thing list. And he set up like really no website at all, but he went to Upwork, which most of us regard Upwork as the kind of lead gen source of last resort. It's like where you go if you're desperate and you can't find work any other way, yeah. Right? That's the reputation it has. Just on a lark, he tweaked his Upwork profile. Like he had it, but had kind of abandoned it and not used it for a number of years as his business has started to become more successful. And he just put in some stuff about blockchain. And it was like this floodgate of inquiries had been opened. And it was clear why. It's because, you know, he was saying he can help with projects involving this very hot, overheated, overhyped technology. And he has been beating work off with a stick ever since. And like there's been some like seriously good work that has found him through this. So again, it just I don't know. I guess sometimes I think of myself as a professional pessimist, and I feel like I'm always telling people there's exceptions to everything. Lots of things can work. Let's look at the risks. You know, let's make sure this is prudent. But even, you know, kind of shitty places to find work like Upwork can, under the right circumstances, be a valuable way to do what I think is the first part of our framework, which is to find prospective clients or to contact them. You know, I'm thinking of Mark Butler's 3-part revenue cycle. Folks who haven't heard of Mark's podcast, The Mark Butler Show, should fix that right now. It's a great podcast that you should check out.
Yep.
But that's the first of his three. His very framework, I think, is really nice. You know, you have to have a way to contact prospective clients, or, you know, for them to find out about you.
So this is his
aware of you.
This is his marketing sales delivery model, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then another client of mine, I suggested he set up an Upwork profile simply as a sort of market demand test. Mm-hmm. And just today he and I were talking, and he told me that a pretty interesting lead found his way to him through that. So they saw his Upwork profile, went and checked out his website, which, listen, I'm not joking when I say it has 3 lines of text on it. It has a headline, you know, thing we do, market we do it for, and then it has like some subheading, and then it has a phone number. Those are literally the only 3 lines of text on their website.
Okay.
And he has a serious lead on the hook that he's talking to about a serious project. So, lots of things can work.
Well, and so, just to drive the point home too, the takeaway from this is not to go create a web page with 3 lines of text and a button. It's to think about, and you know, what I should have done is initially I talked about having some sort of functional model for mm-hmm. how much marketing infrastructure. So to me, you said it best, we need some way to engage with potential clients. Mm-hmm. Then we need some basic proof points. Yep. So it could be a website, it could be an Upwork page, it could be whatever, a LinkedIn page, a way to create more people that we can talk to. So if you wanted to create an audience, an email list would be great. And then the next thing is we need a way to communicate with them on a regular basis. And we don't need to communicate with everybody at once, although that totally works. And Philip, you do well with that. And actually, I was hoping you could talk for a second about, so you email every day, like, you know, on the webinar we did earlier today, we got the question, what is the ROI of this? Yeah. And so I thought that question, it's a hard question because of the way ROI is calculated to begin with. But I was wondering, when you think of the return for you on your daily emails and your daily communications with the people who are on your list, how do you think about what that creates for you?
Boy, it's, I don't know, man. It's like a kind of pin the tail on the donkey thing, because there's a lot of facets of that produce value for my business. And some of them are easy to assign value to, like, you know, a person joins my email list and then they hit reply on an email that I've sent out, and some threshold has been crossed and they're ready to pay me money.
Yeah.
Right. That's like, those are the easy ones to say, well, you know, that produced value. I can look at money in the bank or an invoice, or I can look at a spreadsheet and have some kind of number. And the easy ones to me are not necessarily always the important ones, but that happens. You know, it generates clients. It generates leads, because I have figured out a few things. There's room for improvement for sure, but you know, I've got an email course that seems relevant to people. Like, it's been around for years in largely the same form, and people sign up for it. So, that's awesome. I'm not dismissing the value of that. But then there's also things like writing daily and daily is every weekday. You know, I do kind of take the weekends off, and I don't email my list on the weekends unless I'm running some kind of launch or promotion or something that I want to close on a Sunday night. Anyway, writing that frequently is like going to the gym that frequently, except I don't get in any better shape. In fact, my posture and fitness probably get worse as a result of spending time in front of the computer. But it's a gym for my expertise. Like my expertise grows by forcing myself to think about how I can be helpful to my audience literally 5 days a week and produce something that I'm not embarrassed to show them. Although I have sent some emails that I regret, and I have sent some emails that were not very good. I know that, but that's just all in the game. You know, you're going to have workouts at the gym. You're going to, you know, show up and do your thing, and it's going to suck. And that's just part of life. So I don't worry about that too much, but basically, having to do something hard that builds a skill or creates, adds expertise or makes me more thoughtful or means I've thought through one more aspect of this. It's like going to a gym it's like, I'm impressed with the results. I got to say that may be the most valuable aspect, Liston, is that I might be the biggest beneficiary of my email list.
Right.
Even though it's, you know, it's getting close to 5,000 people. It's, you know, it's growing. Like I could point to those numbers and say, look, clearly I'm doing something awesome. And it's not wrong to do that, but, and then there's the trust factor, the way it positions me as an expert, because who the hell can write about the same topic day in, day out, 5 days a week for years on end? I've been doing this since January, 2016. Who can do that? There's only one kind of person that can do that, is an expert who's just like a fountain of knowledge that there's, again, not every email is great. I'm not trying to like fluff up myself here, but I'm saying that I really do think that's the effect that it has on people.
I was going to say the only person who could do that in the world is a Philip Morgan, and I only know one of those.
Well, but you know, an expert in, you know, Jonathan Stark, and he does the same thing. And so he's, you know, going to be perceived as an expert on pricing.
Well, so that's I wanted to share a really direct story based on my email. So I had a lead come in the other day, just popped in my inbox. It was with a guy who hopefully is not listening to this. I won't name it, but we had a conversation 2 years ago. Apparently I have no recollection of this whatsoever. And he responded to an email that I had sent him with just sort of like a one sheet of my services, right? That I would send out to potential referrals who would say, hey, do you have anything I could reference in case I need to reference it later? So I sent him the little one sheet. This is in 2016. Mm-hmm. And he responded to that email and he said, hey, I know the CEO who could use your help. And so I called him immediately and I said, hey man, just curious, like, how did you even remember me? Like, we haven't had any contact. And he goes, well, I see your emails come in my inbox every day to every day.
Yeah.
I said, really? He goes, yeah, I don't even read them.
And that's the honesty. That's great.
Yeah, I said, really? He goes, yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes, but like, I see your name all the time. So I immediately thought of you when I talked to this guy.
Right.
And I thought, oh, interesting. So I agree with you. So I've been writing a daily blog and that's every day. And that's been, I don't know, 80 some days now. I'm congrats, excited. Dude. Thank you. I'm excited to get to 100. And the thing that I would say about writing anything on a regular basis, so this is a little bit beyond the marketing infrastructure talk, but writing anything on a regular basis, it cements your ideas. And I find all the time now I'm in conversation and I go, oh yeah, I wrote about that the other day. I can send you an article on that. It's super short, but it really crystallizes what you just said. And it's like the birthplace of all my next best ideas. And sometimes they suck and that's okay. But I try to err on the side more of speed these days than perfection, because I've been living in the perfection trap and at some points in my career, and I just find that it doesn't serve me. So it's much better to force yourself to publish something and get it out. So I agree with you. I think there's all kinds of benefits to having an email list. And I think the biggest thing is it gives you lots of options down the road if it's something that you want to do. But you do have to commit to it.
So from a functional, just lest folks think that like you and I both have, I think, an affinity for using email. It's a good fit for us. We like it. You know, I like how fluid a medium it is. It's almost like it disappears after it's sent. So I don't feel like I have to go back and update old stuff. Right. It feels more like a conversation because I send it out, you know, at scale to about 4,500 people. And then some of them reply and it instantly converts from this broadcast thing to like an intimate one-on-one conversation. That's what I mean when I say it's fluid. It's like, you know, they're not replying on Twitter where everybody can see them. So they'll maybe share some stuff that they wouldn't share publicly, et cetera.
Well, also they don't need to log in. They don't need to check another thing. Everybody goes to their inbox at least.
Yeah.
Most everybody goes at least once a day and often like 8 to 10 times a day.
Yeah. I would say only Facebook is as woven into people's everyday lives as email.
Yep.
So anyway,
so
the function of this is building trust. That's how I see it. Pure and simple. It's building trust. That's where it fits in functionally. And there's other, I think we should, you know, for folks who may not find email natural or easy, or who heeded our warning to not build an email list because they don't need that. There's no role in their business for that. They still need to build trust, right? So what can they do? What are things that might be parts of their marketing infrastructure?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess it depends. So that if their goal is to build trust, I mean, I would say, you know, you could think about obviously doing what we're doing now, record a podcast, be a great thing to do. So Mark has done, I've marveled maybe on this podcast, but definitely to a lot of people that I never thought a one-man podcast could be interesting. And he does a really good job of making his one-man podcast interesting. I think you need some way. You know, if you're looking to build trust with a large-ish group of people, say at least tens, if not hundreds of people, it's got to be a one-to-many medium, right? So
yeah, some kind video, of broadcast type medium.
Yeah, something that can be made once and consumed over and over and over again.
Right.
So it could be writing. It could be, so, you know, if you don't have a blog and you want to get noticed for your writing, medium.com is a place to do that without having to maintain anything. Again, you're kind of subject to whatever changes they make later, but I use that as a backup or kind of a way to syndicate my content. So that's an option. You know, video, podcasting, guest starring elsewhere. So, you know, being on someone else's thing by doing a presentation or writing for them. We, you know, we've seen that done to great effect where, like, I've had a friend who wrote for Forbes for a while, and all he needed to do was write a Google Doc and send it to the editor, and they published it and handled everything else for him. And that built a hell of a lot of trust and credibility. His company was later bought by GoDaddy. I'm not suggesting it's because he wrote for Forbes, but it was one of the proof points.
Isn't that the recipe, right? For Forbes, get bought.
Not anymore. They take a lot of people.
No, that's exactly what we're saying. It's like none of these are recipes. They're just like frameworks and, like, you know, here's all these ingredients you can mix together. I would say with Forbes is, this is somebody, I heard somebody else say this, but I think they're right, that Forbes is probably the next platform that's going to become like Huffington Post, where they don't accept just submissions from anybody's.
Well, they're going to have to, because it's gotten out of control. That's the main reason I haven't been pursuing any of these major publishers, because I think they're going to shut it all down, and I think they need to. So if you look at Harvard Business Review has kept a much tighter lock on it, or a magazine that I love is The Atlantic. They write about politics, not business, but it's not open to anybody. Or like The Verge is a great, Vox Media is a great example of a media company that didn't accept a bunch of outside voices, and they've grown like crazy because they only publish high quality. They don't do volume. And that's going to be the way things are going, because there's already more content in the world than all humans on the face of the earth could consume collectively. So something's got to stop. So I agree with you there. And then I think the last point, Philip, that I'd like to make is, so we've got three basic things. Our goal is to have conversations with prospective clients. So you need a basic proof point. You need a way to create an audience, or some way to get more of those potential people who mm-hmm. who could hire you. We want a way to communicate with them regularly, and that's where email, social posting, carrier mm-hmm. pigeons, whatever you have in mind, that's where that comes in. And then, of course, the last thing, and this is kind of a nice to have, or maybe as you move forward in your business a little bit more, is there's got to be some sort of way for you to learn what to create next for them. So we got a really wise question today on the webinar, and that was, hey, I have this audience of people who listen to what I say. And actually, Philip, I'd like to follow up with this person. They listen mm-hmm. to what I say, but I don't know. I want to monetize the audience. First of all, wrong mindset. I want to monetize the audience, he says, but I don't know what to make for them. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing that I like to do is reach out to people. And to me, you don't need much marketing infrastructure to do this. So I find if I do a webinar, if I do whatever, an article, if I write something on LinkedIn and people like it, and it's a direction that I was kind of thinking I might want to go in my business, yeah. I'll reach out to them and say, hey, I have some questions for you. Would you be willing to jump on a call? Now, here's mm-hmm. the marketing infrastructure that powers that. Google Calendar, Calendly, and Zoom.us.
Ooh, some exotic stuff, buddy. You're on the bleeding edge there.
Well, so all of that together costs, I don't know, $40 a month.
And I mean, Zoom can be free. Gmail, Google Calendar, like a lot of that stuff can be free.
Right.
Anyway, it's very inexpensive is what we're saying.
Very inexpensive. And those are the tools that are going to be the most likely to enable these conversations in a very frictionless way. Yeah. And, or at least it limits the friction.
Yeah.
And so I'm, you know, when it comes to what do I do next, or how do I make this better, or how do I serve more people, rather than saying, how do I monetize this? I'd rather ask the question, what can I make that's going to help these people like really kick ass? Yeah. You know, I would recommend reaching out to them directly and just asking. People really like hearing from you.
Yeah, I got to say, you know, I'm often busier than I would like, but if some startup founder reaches out to me and is like, hey, you know, we want to blah, blah, blah. Like I've had this happen a few times yep. where they want to get on a Skype call and find out what I need. It's just like, I don't know. It's like French fries for me. It's irresistible. Even though I know I shouldn't, I'm like, yes, I want to get on the phone with you and be heard.
Yeah, right. Well, and also, I mean, so Philip, you have a list of 5,000 people. If you reached out, you put away your email marketing platform and you just jumped into Gmail and you looked up some people who'd replied to your emails and you reached out to them directly and said, hey, I have some questions about this thing you said. Would you be open to having a call? I would guess 4 out of 5 would say yes immediately. And they'd probably even be surprised. Like, oh, there, you know, the Wizard of Oz contacted me. Like, I didn't think I'd ever actually talk to Philip.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had that, something very similar to that happen on numerous occasions. Like I reached out on behalf of a client one time to a list member where I thought it would be a win-win for them to meet. And the list member was like, oh my gosh, you know, the Philip has reached out to us. They were, again, not trying to fluff myself up here, just saying
it
really does work that way. Yeah.
Well, so I did want to make a point here about, I don't know if the right word is authority. I don't think the right word is authority, but, credibility. So I had someone once say to me, oh, I was so surprised that you replied to my email. And mm-hmm. I thought, why? That's weird. Why do you say that? Oh, you just seem so busy and so successful. Yeah. And I said, first of all, okay, thanks. But why did you think that? What signals did you pick up on that made you think that? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you have a blog and it's, you know, your website looks great and you're in all these places and other people I trust also have you on their website. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, right. Okay. So, you know, I think as we talk about these basic proof points and building trust and credibility, as you're building some of this infrastructure and leveraging it, it just naturally lends itself to doing that for you. Sort of, there are all these signals that people are picking up that imply that you're someone with credibility and with trust.
That's a good point. I feel compelled, like it's always in my contract to say, you can take a very minimalistic approach to this stuff.
Yep.
So like we're throwing out all these ideas and please don't anybody get the idea that, you know, you need 10 different of these things, or it's a numbers game, or it's about scale, or it's about, you know, magnitude of whatever, like being, like one of the things that does build trust is being everywhere. And
yes.
I should put sort of air quotes around everywhere because nobody can be everywhere, but online, if you give yourself 3 to 5 years, you can absolutely dominate something. And,
yes.
And you know, like if your thing is podcast guesting, you can be on 50 or 100 podcasts in 3 to 5 years. If you,
oh, you could
at
be
it.
On 100 in a year if you're diligent.
Yeah, I mean, if you're bonkers diligent. But
well, and also,
even if you're half-assing it, in 5 years, you could be on that many.
Well, Philip, I think we have our next topic, which is how to be everywhere online. And I think what one thing that I would add to that is, you can appear to an individual to be everywhere online without actually being everywhere online. So why don't we talk about that next
time?
But
yeah, exactly. Let's shelve that for later. But I just want to say, you don't have to be there in year one. And in fact, if you try to do that, you'll probably undermine your own effectiveness. And I think a more minimalistic, incremental, lean approach where you're like, okay, I'm busy, but I know because the smart guys, Philip and Liston, said in a year or two, I'm going to be freaking out if I don't start building this infrastructure now. And while you're super busy, and also, you know, a sort of characteristic of being new at business is you're not as efficient as you will be 5 years from now. You're not as good at your craft.
That's you know, an understatement.
So yeah, right. So you're busy and also kind of wastefully busy, right? So you don't have a ton of time to do this. And so I just want to encourage the folks at home to say, okay, what is one, you know, one way I can get better at connecting with the people I'm trying to find? What's one way I can get better at building trust with them?
Well,
and
do
take it easy.
I'll do one better. The reason we presented the content or the different steps or stages of your infrastructure in this way is because they built from most basic and most necessary to kind of nice have and least necessary and most advanced. So if you don't have some sort of way to open up a conversation with someone new, address that first.
Yes.
Don't build an email list, right? So focus on, you know, your website or your about.me page or whatever it is. Like focus on that first and then move your way through, okay, how do I create an audience? How do I communicate with that audience? How do I learn more about what they want? Move your way through those steps later. Like don't, and definitely to your point, Philip, don't do it all at once. Just one at a time, slow and steady. The tortoise and the hare, very real thing, yeah. Right? Slow and steady definitely wins this game. And if you're here, like Philip and I, to build a 20-year business, I don't know what your goal is, Philip, but for me, I look at this and I think, yeah, 20 years from now, I could still be doing this. And that would be amazing because I can't even imagine the momentum and inertia that I would have built in that time. So, you know, slow and steady. You're going to have time to do it. It's going to take some time and it will work.
So it feels like we're about to wrap up. Can you just reiterate those, your sort of framework? Mine is a little different, it's expressed differently, but let's just each reiterate the framework that we're kind of going from here.
So the big idea is, how do I have more conversations with potential clients? And the first thing is, I need some basic proof point and a way to open up those conversations. Second thing would be, how do I create a bigger audience of people who I could have conversations with? The third thing is, how can I communicate with them? So social media or email. We talked about email lists a lot. And then the last thing is, how can I determine from them what's the next best way for me to help them and evolve my business?
Mm-hmm. mine is basically how can you connect and build trust with prospects. It's simpler because it doesn't really incorporate the sales part of the cycle, or the delivery part. And so I'm more focused on that just in my business. And that's why my framework's a little simpler. You're more focused on sales and, you know, some of those things. So how can you connect with people? That means you have to know who they are, who you're trying to connect with. And then a lot of answers start becoming a lot easier when you know who you're trying to connect with and how can you build trust with them? I think those two questions, if you really wrestle with them, are going to transform a lot of people's businesses for the better.
Well, on behalf of the audience, I just want to say thank you to the Philip Morgan.
My pleasure. The Listen Witherill.
Wonderful. Thanks, Philip.
Good to talk to you, dude.
All right. Bye.